Thank you for tuning in today to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Today, Donald Trump held his first news conference since his election. NPR's White House correspondent Tamara Keith covered it. Tamara, welcome to KUOW.
Good to be with you.
Trump said that now he does think Russia hacked the Democratic National Committee. Why does it matter what Trump says he believes about this case?
Well, for a very long time, the intelligence community has expressed a belief that it was Russia that did the hacking. Then the intelligence community came out with a report on Friday that was a declassified report. They also briefed President-elect Donald Trump that day, saying that not only did Russia do the hacking, but that it was part of a campaign to hurt Hillary Clinton, and that ultimately Russia came to a position of favoring Donald Trump in the presidential campaign. But Donald Trump, since that briefing, hadn't commented on whether he believed Russia was behind it. Before that, he had said that he didn't think Russia was behind it, and had questioned the intelligence community and whether, you know, they could get things right since they got the weapons of mass destruction wrong in Iraq. So at this press conference, he says, yeah, as for the hacking, I think Russia did it. About 45 minutes later, a reporter asked another question saying, as you said, Russia is behind this, and then moved on with the question. And Trump said, well, you know, maybe Russia's behind her. Maybe it's somebody else. So he kind of wiggled a little bit by the end.
Okay, so still wiggling in a sense. And Trump did deny these unsubstantiated reports that Russia has compromising personal and financial information about him. So what do you think happens next? It's unsubstantiated. He says it's phony. And then what?
Yeah, and he denied it in a pretty colorful way, talking about, you know, saying they've got cameras in hotel rooms. I tell all my people, be careful when you go to hotel rooms, especially in other countries. They have cameras. Also said that he's a germaphobe. So what comes next? I think that the real question is, as president of the United States, what is his posture toward Russia? And how does that match up with Republicans in Congress, for instance, how they want to proceed as relates to Russia. Mara Liasson, my colleague who was there at the press conference, asked Trump this question, didn't really get an answer, but asked whether Donald Trump would keep the sanctions in place against Russia and whether he would support legislation by people like Senator Lindsey Graham, who want to put in even tougher sanctions to sort of hit back at Russia for this meddling in the election. Trump didn't really answer that question. He instead made fun of Senator Graham. That is going to be the big policy question going forward, is how does the president-elect relate to Russia? Because they're, you know, unsubstantiated as these as this report that has been circulating is, there is also the intelligence community report that says very clearly that Russia did meddle in the election and did favor Trump. And that is a cloud that hangs over him and will prompt people to look especially critically at his relationship with Russia going forward, which he says could end up not being a great relationship, or it could be good. He says that if Vladimir Putin says nice things about him, why would that be a bad thing?
Right. Tamara, talking with White House correspondent for NPR, Tamara Keith, there's so many different allegations to discuss. I want to say another word about this unsubstantiated report.
Unverified.
You know, I've heard maybe that came from a British spy, maybe. But I want to circle back to it because you said a little bit about it. You mentioned hotel rooms. You mentioned Trump being a germaphobe. The New York Times is saying a little bit more, but not much. How are you characterizing this and why?
Yeah, you know, we at NPR are not getting into the details of what was in this report that's been circulating. It's out on the internet. I've read it. A lot of people have read it. But we are not talking about the specifics because they are basically impossible to prove. And therefore, we can't stand behind it with our reporting.
You said a lot of people have read it. I have read that this report has been circulating among the White House press corps for a while. Did you or your NPR colleagues know about this previous to now and decide not to publish?
Not in my specific inner circle at NPR, but you know, other reporters, a reporter from Mother Jones wrote about the existence of it, but did not publish the details because he couldn't substantiate it. That was months ago. Harry Reid, the former Senate Minority Leader, sent a letter to FBI Director James Comey saying, "I know you have information about Donald Trump and Russia that you aren't talking about," that has widely been believed to be a reference to this report that, again, had been circulating both on Capitol Hill and among some journalists, though not me or the other White House correspondents.
As you know, Tamara, sometimes it's not the misdeed that matters the most. It's the cover-up. I'm not alleging a cover-up, but I wondered whether Trump was going to go on the record with a denial that his opponents will continue to try to hang on him during his presidency. Did you get any sense like that?
I think that the biggest problem for him potentially coming out of this press conference is right at the end of the press conference, right before he ended it, a correspondent for ABC News asked him, "Can you say that conclusively no one from that you know or worked with or from your campaign spoke with Russia or anyone from Russia in or connected to the Russian government in the lead up to the election or during the campaign?" She also asked a second question about what he would say to Putin. Well, Trump answered the second half of the question. He never answered the first half of the question, and then he ended the press conference. So as he was leaving, another reporter shouted after him, asking that question again. He did not turn around to answer it. So there is this big outstanding question, which he did not conclusively deny, though one assumes that if there is a denial to be done, that his campaign, his transition team will clean up afterwards, though that has not happened yet. So it's hanging out there for now.
On other matters, Tamara, Trump's lawyer described how he will handle potential conflicts of interest with his business. Do you think this is going to silence his critics?
No, definitely not. Because although Donald Trump is signing away management of the Trump companies to his two sons, he is not giving up ownership. And there's no way that he won't know what his sons are up to, even if they, you know, create firewalls and say they promise they won't talk about it at family dinners. And still, Donald Trump would stand to benefit from whether that business is successful or not. But they, you know, the way that Trump and his lawyer describe it, the sort of wide-ranging business that he has is such that maybe there was no way for him to untangle it and to completely avoid conflicts of interest. That's at least the argument they're making. The other argument being that conflict of interest laws do not technically apply to the president of the United States.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Finally, this was such an atypical presidential news conference, Trump calling BuzzFeed a failing pile of garbage and refusing to take a question from CNN. How does Trump's style change the way you do your job, do you think?
That's a very interesting question. I think that we here is my answer. When reporters asked multi-part questions, he only answered one of the parts. And so I think that to me, that my takeaway is if I get a question to Donald Trump at a press conference, I am going to ask a very clear, concise, and single point question. I am not going to ask a multi-part question because that is just, it seems, a guaranteed way to not have your question fully answered. And you know, the whole idea of a press conference, the whole goal is to get clear answers, firm answers. And I think the way to do that is to ask clear questions.
You know, I noticed that Trump wouldn't take that CNN reporter's question, and the next reporter he did call on could have just re-asked that question. Would you expect the press corps to act more like a team in a case like that?
You know, the reality is the press corps actually already does kind of act like a team where, you know, if a question isn't answered in a satisfying way, another reporter will ask it again in a different way. Or if a question has been asked in a way that is sort of satisfactory, then, you know, you won't get five reporters asking the same question all over again. They'll move over to other topics that that aren't covered. And in this case, the ABC correspondent ultimately did ask basically the same question that the CNN correspondent had been trying to ask. So the question did get asked, though ultimately didn't get answered.
What a fascinating job Tamara Keith has, NPR's White House correspondent, today covering Donald Trump's first news conference since the presidential election. Tamara, thank you for this. Hoping to talk again.
Yeah, absolutely. This was so much fun.
KUOW's The Record. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Since Donald Trump's election, a sanctuary movement has started at hundreds of college campuses around America. The aim is to protect undocumented students and staff from immigration enforcement. At Eastern Washington University near Spokane, a sanctuary petition there calls for the university to protect students' identities and refuse to cooperate with deportations. We asked a student at Eastern what a sanctuary campus would mean to her. She is undocumented, so we are not using her name.
Hello, I'm a junior here at Eastern Washington University, and I came to the U.S. when I was 5 years old from Mexico. What I like about EWU is that they do a great job to be able to create that Eagle family when you come to Eastern. They also offer resources that any student can use, like the Writing Center, the library. If EWU becomes a sanctuary campus, to me personally would be a relief to not have to worry and stress about if my education would be taken away from me at any time. The sanctuary campus position that came out, that keeps us safe and be able to pay attention to our studies instead of having to worry, you know, is this going to be my last day here at school? Is it going to be my last day here seeing my friends and families? Life on campus is different for undocumented students because there's things that happen to us that we can't tell anybody because there's nobody on campus that actually, you know, understands what we're going through. Like if a family member was deported, who we would talk to, if we need legal advice. And we have stories from other friends who say, oh, I've been to this department, you know, they weren't really friendly to undocumented students. We don't have somewhere we can go and feel safe. And so that's why I think it's a great idea to be able to create that multicultural center where there's at least a staff there that would be able to help. What I want more people to know is just to get educated about an undocumented person or undocumented student because there's a lot of myths out there and we're just trying to create a better life for our family. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to our stories.
Sanctuary petitions are also circulating on at least six other college campuses in Washington, including UW, WSU, and Whitworth. This story was produced by KUOW's Liz Jones, who joins us now to talk more about these campus efforts. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Bill.
So we just heard from a student at Eastern Washington University about this sanctuary petition. How has that school's administration responded to the petition?
Yeah, well, the board took public comment from students and staff and faculty. They decided not to adopt the sanctuary label, but they did put out a statement, and they refer to Eastern as, quote, more than a sanctuary. And they outline kind of what that means. That means they have zero tolerance for harassment and discrimination. They protect the safety of all students, regardless of their immigration status. And they protect their students' information. That means their immigration status or their personal ID. They keep that private. Eastern Washington University police also don't ask for a person's immigration status when they have interactions. That's the same as at the UW campus here. The petition, though, calls for Eastern to actively refuse to comply with immigration on raids and deportations. The board responded they have no legal power to block ICE from campus, so they can't meet that request. The petition also calls for an office to support undocumented students, a multicultural resource, as we heard the student say, but the board didn't really address that specific request there.
And there are something like 200 petitions like this going on now around the country. Are they basically the same petition?
It's interesting. There's a student at Pomona College in California that's been tracking all of these. He's made a spreadsheet with links to every single petition so far. So, and he's also provided a template or a guide. So there is some boilerplate there for sure. But there's a range of what these petitions include, from staff training on how to work with immigrant and refugee students or what their specific issues might be, requests for stricter data retention and destruction policies on campuses, and other ways to ensure student IDs are protected. Several are asking for this kind of resource center or a safe place where undocumented students can go and meet and talk about issues. They cite the UW often as a model for that. We have that here on the UW campus. But at the core, they're all asking for one thing, and that is for officials not to cooperate with federal immigration agents on deportations and enforcement.
Right. And Eastern Washington's administration didn't seem to fully embrace that. How realistic is it to expect colleges to not cooperate with federal immigration?
Well, most schools have responded that they have no legal power to restrict agents, as we heard from Eastern, but they can do other things like refuse to share information, that type of thing. But Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the feds, they do have specific guidelines when it comes to what they call sensitive locations. And that includes schools and universities, also churches, hospitals, funerals, public marches and rallies. These are called sensitive locations.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah. So police say enforcement actions should not occur or not be focused on these sensitive locations, except in certain situations. So what does that mean? If it's an emergency, like a matter of national security, or there's a risk to someone's physical harm or to property, another situation might be if law enforcement actions lead them to a sensitive location, like someone is on the run, they're facing arrest and they're on the run, they end up on a campus, they're there. Or if agents get prior approval. So those are all situations where immigration would potentially move into a sensitive location. But the DHS memo, the federal memo, the purpose for it, they say, is to avoid unnecessary alarm in local communities.
And overall, how are college administrators responding to these petitions?
Yeah, this student at Pomona who I mentioned, he's also mapped this out. So there's a nice map to see. And the Chronicle of Higher Education has also reported on this. The majority of them, there's been no response yet. It looks like about 10 schools so far have said yes, we'll take that term sanctuary status or sanctuary campus. 4 said no, we don't support that term. And about 50 schools have responded kind of in the middle saying, we support the idea, we're not going to take that label of sanctuary though. And that's where most of the schools in Washington fall. So the University of Washington, Washington State University over on the eastern side of the state, they have committed to this idea. They've written letters of support outlining their values and resources for immigrant students, undocumented students, all students. But the sanctuary term kind of puts schools in a tricky position right now. It's a symbolic term, but it's also a lightning rod right now. We've heard President-elect Trump come out and say that he will block funding to sanctuary cities with similar policies. And there's a concern that could extend to college campuses also. And we're already seeing some lawmakers in other states taking this step. In Texas, the governor there has said he would cut funding for any schools with a sanctuary label. Lawmakers in Georgia and Arkansas made similar promises. And there is a bill in Congress right now called the No Funding for Sanctuary Campuses Act.
So, KOW reporter Liz Jones, what other impact have you seen these sanctuary campus petitions have on colleges here in Washington?
Yeah, I heard one example from the University of Washington. I spoke with Marisa Herrera. She is the executive director of community building and inclusion at the University of Washington. And she says these letters and petitions have already made a difference. They push students and staff to start talking about their issues and their priorities.
We want to make sure that our work is not in the shadows, that we're proud to come out in support of our students. That's what those letters were about. It was to say affirmatively that we are committed to inclusive space, not just on our respective campuses, but nationwide. We are coming together in solidarity, and our commitment, it's deep and it's personal.
So her point there is really that this helps them be ready for potential changes ahead, be organized, and be focused.
Filling you in on potential changes ahead, that's Liz Jones with KUOW's immigration team. Thank you, Liz.
You're welcome, Bill.
This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Last week, here's how Seattle writer, best-selling author Lindy West described her experience on Twitter. Quote, "I am micromanaged in real time by strangers. Neo-Nazis mine my personal life for vulnerabilities to exploit, and men enjoy unfettered direct access to my brain so they can inform me for the thousandth time that they would gladly rape me if I weren't so fat." So she shut down her Twitter account. Lindy West, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me.
So we just heard about your struggles with Twitter. Was there one breaking point that sent you off Twitter?
It's funny. None of those things that you just read were really the thing, even though I think to a normal person...
it sounds like enough.
Yeah, especially the third one. People would be like, why would you even ever stay there for one day?
Right.
But I've been dealing with that for at least 5 years. That sort of, sexualized, weaponized use of Twitter, trying to erode my mental health. But, that I actually was coping with fine. The turning point for me was the election. It just suddenly felt like I was spending my time sort of validating this really toxic community, which is epitomized by the president-elect taunting North Korea about its nuclear program. I was just watching this happen. A couple things simultaneously. Watching Donald Trump use Twitter to terrorize individual citizens and watching him create potential global catastrophes on this platform, while I was also just sort of personally being distracted and being just wasting a lot of time and energy in this moment where I feel charged to really try to do my best work, in this sort of new scary world.
So that connection you're making, is it just that, man, Donald Trump is just the epitome? Or is there also like a feedback thing? Do you think something's happening on Twitter with Trump and what's okay? Or was everything always there, all along?
I think what we've seen over the last couple of years with this sort of escalation of the disinformation campaign and the fake news, whatever you want to call it, that has sort of swelled and pushed Trump into power, where, I've been dealing with the same people who are these sort of rabid pro-Trump trolls on Twitter. They used to just be rabid anti-feminist trolls who were going after me and my colleagues. And it's literally the same people. I've sort of watched them morph into this army of, really, really aggressive pro-Trump crusaders who are now merging with literal neo-Nazis. And so it's just... for whatever reason, for a complicated web of reasons, Twitter was a really ideal environment. A major reason being, it's pretty much unmoderated. And we've, feminists and people of color and people who've really borne a lot of the brunt of harassment on Twitter for years have been saying, could you please start protecting us? Could you please start instituting some sort of standards and regulations on what kind of... what kind of conduct is acceptable and how much, is hate speech tolerated or not tolerated? And Twitter hasn't really done anything. And eventually it got to this point where this massive throng of people have been able to really dominate that system and dominate, what seems like the truth to people who are not really fully paying attention. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They can push so much disinformation out there with so much aggression that it really, I think, changed the election in a profound way. There was a lot of intimidation going on, a lot of just lies, and all of this was happening on Twitter. And I think Twitter could have done a lot to, set the tone for what is and isn't acceptable on their platform. They're a private company. They can say, yeah, we don't have Nazi, neo-Nazis organize on our platform, but they didn't care to do that. And here we are. I don't know. It's very complicated and this might sound sort of unhinged on my part, but it was really scary to watch it all happen.
It's complicated. Tech companies are struggling with how to jump in on questions of what's good or bad, what's true or false, and what realistically could you expect from Twitter to make it a Lindy Westable place and a habitable place?
Well, I mean, you know, again, it's not, I didn't leave because of trolling specifically. It's much more complicated than that. So a lot of it is just, I really like Twitter, and I found myself using, like, spending a lot of time there. Uh-huh. And I needed to disengage. And I also just didn't want to validate that community with my presence anymore. You know, I don't want to be a part of the same community as Donald Trump. You know what I mean?
But you said that you said you like Twitter. In fact, you said you believe in it as a democratizing force.
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, it falls prey to the same issues as our real democracy, where it still breaks down along these sort of lines of power, and people with power still wield more power on Twitter than people without power. So it's, you know, you still have the most vulnerable people being treated the worst and being driven off the platform. And then you have these sort of entrenched power structures, like, you know, straight white men like Donald Trump and the many, many people who follow him on Twitter, having the most power and the loudest voice and the most control. So, you know, it's like, it's the good and the bad. It's everyone can directly tweet at their favorite movie star or at their congressperson or whatever, but also everyone else who wants us to shut up has direct access to us too. So it's kind of, I think it has been valuable in many ways. And I also think if left unregulated the way that it is, and, you know, Twitter has a terms of service. Like Twitter has stated rules, you know, against hate speech and against targeted harassment. And the problem is enforcement. All we're really asking is, could you please, could you have a clear understanding of what targeted harassment is, and the way that it disproportionately affects marginalized people, and could you please enforce those terms of service?
Is there a model? Is there a social media platform that's doing it right?
No, I don't think so.
Why do you think that is?
I mean, it's really difficult. I'm not a web developer, so you know, people always ask me this, like, how can Twitter fix itself? I don't know. I'm a writer.
You know?
It's not really my job to fix Twitter. It's Twitter's job. But, you know, I think in terms of just manpower, it's difficult to moderate millions and millions of users. I know there are gender imbalances that create a problem. Like, I know that I've heard from people who've tried to work with Twitter to fix these problems that most of the people on the development side are men, and it's sometimes difficult to even perceive what problems might be that don't affect you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's an argument for why we need more women in tech, why we need to support, you know, programs that increase representation, diverse representation, which is exactly the kind of thing that this army of Donald Trump Twitter trolls freaks out about if you mention. And there's a reason. Like, it's all, there's a very clear motivation behind that.
Does Twitter create meanness or just reveal it?
Well,
shine a light on it.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
light shining's good, right?
Yeah, I guess. I guess. I mean, there's a line between shining a light on something and validating something and normalizing something. Normalization is really what we've seen happen in a really insidious way over the last few years. You know, it's become normal to, you know, tell a feminist that she should go kill herself. Mm-hmm. And that sort of creeping erosion of our social mores has had a big effect on Trump's electability. But, you know, I think Twitter didn't create cruelty, obviously. Yeah. But obviously, like, anonymity definitely fosters cruelty, for sure. And I think it has become kind of a game. It's become sort of gamified and incentivized to, you know, like, trolling is is a culture now where people do this for fun and they compete with each other and they try to impress each other. And it's, you know, Twitter is a great environment for that. So, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. This is the way that people behave. People are cruel to each other. People create social hierarchies. People try to, you know, break other people down to make themselves feel better, or on a bigger level to retain power. And, you know, Twitter just happened to have been a very fruitful platform for that. But no, it's not new.
You said that you miss Twitter. How do you connect now with the people you want to connect with in the ways you were doing before?
I feel really disconnected. It's kind of scary. I don't miss it because it's...
You had how many followers?
It's like 95,000 or something. Uh-huh. And what I miss is the plurality of perspectives. It's easy to get information from mainstream news sources. You know, I have newspaper subscriptions. I read the news. But in terms of getting perspectives that aren't represented in mainstream newspapers, there's just no better way than Twitter to get real-time, really, really smart analysis of here's what's going on in the news. Here's a person with a different perspective recontextualizing this piece of news in a way that, you know, the New York Times didn't, because of the breakdown of that newsroom, because of, you know, XYZ, whatever factors contribute to how news is reported. You know, nothing's actually objective. And so I miss that. And I miss, you know, I primarily use Twitter to joke around with people. You know, it's a community and it's fun. So I miss that. But, you know, I'm still on Facebook, which has its own wealth of problems that I hate. I hate Facebook, too. I hate everything. But I did read a book. You know,
you read a book.
I read a book. Huh. Sort of. I started a book.
You got about 140 characters in.
Right. Exactly. And I was like, oh, man, this is long. Yeah.
So you're going to go back to Twitter someday?
No, I don't know. Okay. Maybe not. I don't have any concrete plans. I mean,
what did you think that it was news? It was even trending on Twitter that Lindy West left Twitter.
I know.
Weird?
I was trending higher than Charles Manson. Finally.
Touche.
Yeah, I know.
Congratulations.
Really stick it to that guy. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It was weird. I only knew that I was trending on Twitter because people kept texting me about it, because I'm not on Twitter. I don't know what's going on Twitter. But I was surprised that it was a story at all. I mean, I made it into a story to a degree because I wrote a column about it. Mm-hmm. But I kind of thought that a person could use a website or not use a website, and that was fine. You know, I didn't realize that it was going to be.
But you're digging at something really important to all of us.
Yeah, I guess so. And that was, you know, partially intentional. I think it's important to remember that, you know, it's a privilege to be able to just quit. I don't have to worry about whether or not this is going to affect me professionally, because I work for big media companies that promote my work no matter what. So even if I'm not personally on Twitter, my work is being promoted on Twitter by The Guardian or by The New York Times or whoever I'm writing for. So it's not the same as a struggling writer, especially a marginalized person, trying to get their work seen and trying to become successful and get a foothold. That it's a much higher stakes for those people to quit Twitter than for me. Like, I can sort of do this experiment and call Twitter's bluff about whether or not it's necessary to be successful and to self-promote on their platform. I can be like, I think it's fine. I'm just going to go. But hopefully, by turning this into a big stink, which was, again, semi-accidental, if Twitter actually listens and makes their platform a little bit safer for people who really need it and who don't have the luxury of just up and quitting, that's great. I would be thrilled.
Some people don't have bestsellers like Shrill. Lindy West does. Seattle Zone. It's really good to see you again. Thank you for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You have a platform here. You know that, right?
I'll be here. I'll come in every day and just ramble.
Excellent. KUOW, Seattle, talking with Lindy West, author of Shrill, and we'll be back with more, so stay tuned. As the Seattle area gets more expensive, people adapt, like They move farther away for affordable housing. But what happens when you still need to work in the city, say at a hospital in Seattle's core? KUOW's Carolyn Adolph with our Region of Boom team went to find out.
We each strike a bargain with the places where we live and work. Eileen Donaher's bargain involves two small children and a baby.
I can't hold both you and Liam at the same time.
A house in the suburb of Snohomish, bought near the market low in 2011.
Thank God.
And a job as a nurse at the University of Washington Medical Center.
I love the UW. I'm kind of a lifer.
Here's the deal. Eileen Donaher works the 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. shift to dodge the heaviest commuting periods. Even so,
the commute in the morning, it's definitely about 45 minutes to an hour.
Giving her around a 14-hour workday, a few days a week.
We can make it work.
Donaher's lucky. She and her husband are living the life they chose. But there's rising concern that more and more people who work near the center of the city are being pushed out farther than they would choose.
That spatial mismatch between their work and where they live provides all kinds of stress.
This is Marty Koistra, executive director of the Seattle Housing Consortium.
It's hard on the environment, transit time, and really, I think, takes away from the opportunities that families have to live and grow and thrive together when so much time is spent away from home.
This is the story for some of Eileen Donaher's nursing colleagues. The Washington State Nurses Association surveyed its members about their work-life crunch about a month ago. Here are some of the responses.
I recently quit my job at Children's due to the commute being too much. It turned my 12-hour shift into a 14-hour or longer day.
I couldn't afford to buy a house in Seattle, so I moved to Renton. But I'm considering a different job because the traffic and time it takes me to commute to and from work doesn't feel worth it anymore.
Some nurses have to live within an hour of the hospital so they can get there when they're called. A nurse at Children's said she lives right around that edge.
Sometimes I have to sit with my uniform on and wait for them to call so I can dash out of the house exactly when they call.
Not everybody can live right next to where they work. When you're talking about these major metropolitan areas, we just think it's important to offer people the opportunity, though.
Marty Koistra of the Housing Consortium. The Housing Consortium works to find affordable housing for people who make less than median income, because this problem gets worse as you look down the income scale. But nurses are on their own because they're middle class. They can only get the opportunity to move closer if costs change or their employers are willing to pay them more. Turns out some pay raises might be coming.
We are staring in the face of a national crisis.
This is Claudia Faust, head of recruiting at Swedish hospitals. Seattle's in growth mode, so Swedish is too. But there's a nurse shortage.
We're looking at probably another 5 to 10 years of really serious competition for talent.
So Swedish has hired relocation specialists to find nurses places to live. But it won't be enough. Faust says it's even been hard to keep people in lower paid positions because of low salaries and long commutes. Faust says her job will be to
minimize the increases of the salaries that we're going to have to pay to get people to come and do the work that we need to do.
But in the Seattle of the next few years, any salary increase could shift the work-life balance in people's lives. I'm Carolyn Adolph, KUOW News.
KUOW's Region of Boom reporting team is looking at how Seattle's growth is affecting our whole region. And if you have a story idea for us along those lines, please go to our website, KUOW.org. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. You've heard tragic stories of artists who died too young. The story you're about to hear is about a children's author. KUOW's poetry correspondent, Elizabeth Austin, is here with a book of poetry for children, a book that has an unusual backstory, including lost manuscripts, World War II, and the poet's early death. Elizabeth, welcome.
Hi, Bill.
So what is this book?
Well, this is a gorgeously illustrated picture book called Are You an Echo? The Lost Poetry of Misuzu Kaneko. And it was published by Seattle's Chin Music Press. It's got a narrative about Misuzu by local journalist David Jacobson.
Who was Misuzu Kaneko?
Mizuzu is the pen name of an exceptional young woman. She was born in a fishing town in western Japan in 1903. She was very well educated for a woman of her time. She was raised in a family of booksellers, and she started writing poetry as a young adult while working at her uncle's bookstore. She was first published in children's magazines. Critics and readers loved her work right away, and I asked David Jacobson what makes her work stand out, and here's what he had to say.
Well, the amazing thing about her is that Japan is considered a country that values the natural environment, values nature and animals and plants and things like that. You see it in the artwork and the culture. However, she was even a league beyond that, and among Japanese is known for her ability to really empathize with animals and plants. For instance, she writes poems about what the snow feels being stepped on, or what a fish feels being eaten on a plate, or what a dog feels that who has broken its leg. So she had a tremendous amount of empathy and kindness, and I think that really comes out when you read her work.
Elizabeth, you mentioned how well-received Misuzu Kaneko's work was in her time, but the book's subtitle is The Lost Poetry of Misuzu Kaneko. How was her poetry lost?
Well, as was pretty common at the time, Misuzu entered into an arranged marriage with a clerk at her uncle's bookstore. It was a disaster. Her husband turned out to be completely unreliable and a philanderer. Not only did he give Misuzu an STD, but once she became popular, he forbade her from writing poetry. So after a few years, she wanted to divorce him, but by then they had a child, and he claimed custody of her. This was 1930, and Japanese law was on his side. So the night before he was to take their daughter away, Misuzu committed suicide and left notes asking her husband to let her mother raise their child. She was just 26, and after she died, her poetry pretty much disappeared.
What a story. So then how is it that we come to be holding this book of her poetry today?
Well, that story begins in Japan and concludes here in Seattle. So here's the first part. In the 1960s, this is 30 years after Misuzu died, a Japanese poet and literary scholar named Setsuo Yazaki came across one of Misuzu's poems in an old children's magazine. And he was so moved by it that he spent the next 16 years searching for details about who she was and hoping to find more of her poems. So ultimately, he found Misuzu's younger brother, who gave him her notebooks. And their pages had over 500 poems.
And that notebook, did that contain the only copy there was of her work?
Well, apparently the only other copy was lost when her editor's home was destroyed during World War II. Setsuo Yazaki had Misuzu's poems published, and after a gap of about 50 years, her work was reintroduced to Japanese readers. And I understand that she's now one of the most well-known and beloved children's poets in Japan. Her poems are even part of the elementary school curriculum. They've been translated into 11 languages, but until now, North American readers didn't really have access to her work.
Until now, what happened?
A Japanese friend introduced David Jacobson to Misuzu's poetry. And as I mentioned, he's a Seattle-based journalist. And he was struck by how accurately Misuzu seemed to capture the perspective of a child across culture and time. And he wanted to bring her poems, her sense of empathy and compassion, to English-speaking children. But because David is a journalist, he also wanted to tell Misuzu's story. So This book is more than a collection of poems. It also shows us in words and in pictures Misuzu's life and environment and the strangely interrupted journey of her poems.
Elizabeth, can we hear one of those poems now?
Yes. So here's David Jacobson introducing Treat, and then we'll hear it read by one of the founders of Chin Music Press, Yuko Enomoto.
One of the things I find most remarkable about Misuzu is the way in which she is able to reach out beyond cultural and time limitations. I think in this particular poem, she reaches to the heart of an issue of a feeling that occurs to many children, be it in the 1900s or now. And it's as relevant to my children as it was to the children then.
Treat. For fun, I hide a treat from my brother, thinking I wouldn't eat it, of course. But I eat it, after all, this one little treat. But what if Mom says, there were two treats? What would I do? Leave the second one? No. Take it. No. Put it back. Well, My brother doesn't come, so I eat it, this second treat. How bitter this treat, how sad it tastes.
I'm listening to that poem, and at the same time in my mind, I'm reading that to my children.
Well, do you want to hear it in the original Japanese?
Yes, yes.
Okashi. Itazura ni hitotsu kakushita ototo no okashi. Tabiru mon ka to omottete tabete shimatta hitotsu no okashi. Okaasan ga futatsu tte ittara dou shiyou. Oite mite, totte mite, mata oite mite. Sore demo ototo ga konai kara.
That was Yuko Enomoto reading Treat by Misuzu Kaneko in the original Japanese. Before that, we heard the English version translated by Sally Ito and Michiko Tsuboi. Elizabeth, before I let you go, can we just say what a lovely book this is visually as well?
Isn't it? It's illustrated by a Japanese artist named Toshikado Hajiri.
I've been looking through it, you know, and it's the illustrations are soft and lovely. And I really like that there's an illustration to go with each poem, but also drawings that take you through the story of who this poet was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think my kids are really going to enjoy this. We're going to tweet out some of the images from the book now so listeners can see those. You can see it for yourself. Again, the title of the book is Are You an Echo? The Lost Poetry of Misuzu Kaneko. Narrative and translation by David Jacobson, Sally Ito, and Michiko Tsuboi. And it's KOW's poetry correspondent, Elizabeth Austin, who brought that to you. Elizabeth, thank you.
You're welcome, Bill.
You have tuned in to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Today, Donald Trump conceded what he had dismissed for weeks, that it was Russia. Maybe. He later said, well, maybe, maybe not. But he did say he thinks it was Russia that hacked Democratic Party computers looking for damaging information about Hillary Clinton. He told reporters today that Russia shouldn't have done it and that hacking like that will be less likely once Trump is in office because he's going to have such a good relationship, a good, strong relationship with Russia. Let us bring in now the Vancouver Sun columnist, Vaughn Palmer. Vaughn, hello to you. You know, unlike the American president, Canada's new foreign affairs minister is a critic, a sharp critic of Putin. What does she say?
Yeah, Canadian government pivoting this week to deal with the challenge of dealing with the new Trump administration in the United States, and they've shuffled their cabinet leadership. We've got a new foreign affairs minister. Interesting choice, a woman named Chrystia Freeland. She's got a couple of things on her resume that are not going to please the president-elect. First of all, she's a very sharp critic of the Putin administration and of Russia. Freeland was the Moscow bureau chief for the Financial Times, so she's also a journalist. And I watched that press conference this morning, Bill. Mm. The Washington Press Corps is in for a long 4 years. I don't know if they can put in for combat pay, but they're in for a wild 4 years. Freeland is interesting because she was a very, very harsh critic of the Putin administration over the treatment of the Ukraine. And that got her the notice of Moscow. She was on a list of 12 Canadians who just 2 years ago were banned by the Putin administration from going to Russia. I assume they'll have to lift the ban now that she's our foreign affairs minister. But in any event, Freeland is a very interesting choice for our government, reinforces its sharp criticism of the Putin administration. She's also very knowledgeable. As I say, she was based in Moscow for the Financial Times, and she speaks Russian and Ukrainian.
And it's seen as a signal from Trudeau that Canada is going to be way tougher with Putin than Trump will.
Yeah, I think we're going to be tough. Now we'll see how we get along.
Right.
She's also got another very important file. They've left her. She was our trade minister before this shuffle to yesterday. She's in charge of Canada-U.S. trade. So she'll be the lead cabinet minister to deal with anything coming from the United States about trade issues, including reopening NAFTA and dealing with, there's been this talk in the Trump administration about a border tax on
U.S. companies that make stuff abroad and then bring it back into the United States. Well, one of the oldest relationships between Canada and the United States is the Automobile Pact, which was signed way back in the 60s. And, of course, there are all kinds of American and Canadian automobiles that are, the parts are made in one country, the assembled vehicles are made in another, they're shipped back and forth. So Canada will be looking for, I guess we'd call it special treatment, or at least recognition of long-standing trade relationships with the United States, and she's going to be in charge of some of that as well.
We're talking with Vaughn Palmer, Vancouver Sun columnist, and Vaughn, Vancouver and Seattle are sharing this cold, snowy winter, and I want you to know I don't mind if your city complains, but the Toronto Globe and Mail writes, quote, "The hysteria that has greeted winter this year has set historic records for wailing and chuntering." Is that true?
Yeah,
have you been chuntering?
Have, actually. We've had scenes in Vancouver that are reminiscent of those near riots that occur in big box stores on Black Friday as people battle over the few discounted goods that are available. But our riots have been over salt to put on sidewalks, steps, and the roads. So the city of Vancouver has made salt available to anybody who wants to pick it up at local fire halls, but there hasn't been enough salt. There have been mob scenes, and in one case, the cops had to be called to sort things out from people essentially battling over access to the salt to take home and put on their sidewalks.
There was a bit of a mocking tone in that piece. Does the rest of Canada make fun of Vancouver for being weather wimps?
Yeah, they do, because, you know, we're so damn smug out here in British Columbia, or in Vancouver and Victoria, about our superior weather and how the rest of the country is in deep freeze from, you know, October through to May. Mm-hmm. And we've actually had a winter in Vancouver. Of course, smugness depends on where you're sitting. I'm looking out my window here in Victoria, and we don't have any snow, so we're kind of laughing at Vancouver's expense a bit as well.
This is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer sharing the weather across the border with you. Always good to talk with you, Vaughn. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Bill.
And good to have you along here on The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Continuing coverage, of course, today of the Trump news conference and allegations and confirmation hearings. And keep it tuned for the news here to KUOW Seattle.